This week's conversation with Lucy Newman of LJN Studio is sponsored by the Embroiderers Guild of America at egausa.org. Each month, EGA offers an expansive roster of creative and educational opportunities for needleworkers around the globe, including the popular virtual lecture series. The October lecture is Este Decado, Mastering Needlework in Mid-19th Century Mexico, with Dr. Lynn Anderson and Dr. Mayela Flores Enriquez. The lecture is October 14 and registration opens September 18. Use the code FiberTalk5, that's FiberTalk and the number 5, to get a $5 discount on this or any of EGA's virtual lectures, including previous recordings. Also, check out the classes that will be offered at the 2024 National Seminar, Preserving Needle Art, which will be held August 14 to 18. Registration opens this month on September 19. Join the Embroiderers Guild of America at egausa.org, and thanks to the EGA for their continued support of Fiber Talk. Now our conversation with Lucy Newman. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from LJN Studio, Lucy Newman. Lucy, welcome.
Hello.
Good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
We got to start with your newest effort, your kind of post-apocalyptic version of what botanicals would look like after a mutation.
Yep, and far into the future.
that is really some thinking there. What made you get onto that path?
Oh, I've been sort of fascinated with mutations, especially after I saw these images of daisies from Chernobyl, and they looked like they'd been photoshopped. They looked stretched and distorted in a way that sort of was quite uniform, you know, very unnatural. And it made me think, oh, wow, what if this was sort of allowed to happen, if there was an experiment where this nature became this sort of new, mutated, wonderful place. And yeah, so in my head, I've been wanting to make this series of work for a long time, but just didn't. I don't know, didn't have the guts to do it or didn't have the time to do it. And for some reason, this is what I've been spending this year doing anyway.
Now, do you start with actual blooms of flowers, like normal ones, and then let your mind go crazy?
I have done both. So for a series that I made for the Hand and Lock Prize last year, I used bouquets of flowers that a friend of mine, they're quite futuristic the way that she makes these posies up. And I asked if I could mutate them, and I took them into Photoshop and stretched and distorted and multiplied, and, you know, still with that idea of these blooms from Chernobyl and this idea of, you know, a natural mutation or, you know, a technological mutation. And I made a series of work with those. But recently I've been working with AI and using AI's version of flowers to mutate, which is quite interesting.
Oh, that is. That is.
Yeah, so, that definitely.
Yeah. So talk about that. How do you do that? What is it, software you use, or what are you using?
Yeah, there's I use it's an open AI program that you can use. I've subscribed monthly to it. It's called DALL-E, and you give it prompts, whatever it may be. A lot of my works are named the prompts that I started with the AI. So a flower after a nuclear mutation in the future in the style of Audubon or something, or a botanical drawing or something like that. And it will generate, usually I think it's 3 or 4 images. And then from those, I will then go back into Photoshop and manipulate them further And then I start the embroidery process from those images that I make after that.
That is so cool. And I love the way that you take probably the original botanical source, Audubon, and and then go way way into the future and tie those two together to create your art. That is
Well, I imagine myself like Audubon being this not necessarily a scientist, but a cataloger, a observer of this future. So when I first started making this series of work, I imagined myself in a world where we don't really use pen and ink anymore, and needle and thread is the way that you record things, let's say. And then, just as Audubon did, I'm just making a study of these new fantastical things. It just happens to be in a needle and with a needle and thread rather than a watercolor, for example.
So, all right. So what do you get for a product out of Photoshop then? You just print out whatever you generate, and then do you prick and pounce it or trace it or something onto ground cloth?
Yeah. It depends. Sometimes I'll, use my iPad and make a line drawing over, whatever I've generated. And then I take that line drawing and I print it directly onto a stabilizer. And then I just use that as my base. Sometimes I prick and pounce. Sometimes I do sort of a little bit of free drawing on a canvas, but I tend to print out things onto a stabilizer just because it saves me a lot of time, that initial process.
Right. So do you use a stabilizer that's like that you can wash off, or one that you kind of, it stays underneath and you trim off what you don't need?
Yeah, I tear it away.
Okay.
Yeah. I actually use a stabilizer, which is for machine embroidery because it's thick. And it just seems to stay in place. And I don't like any of those sort of wash off ones because they always leave a film. And I try to be as environmentally conscious as possible. And I don't know what they're made of, and I'm scared of them. And I think they're probably horrible chemicals.
You're probably right.
And I don't know. Yeah. And I'm not sure about washing it off into the sink. You know, who knows what that is. And, anything that disappears. Yeah, I'm not really sure about that. So sometimes I'll use tissue paper if it's not too complicated, and I could draw on it and I'll just rip that away. But yeah, this stabilizer stuff it looks like almost handmade paper. And I think it's sort of recycled material. So I just use that.
I wondered about that, the wash away stabilizer. Sometimes it's like, I wonder if this is going to gum up my sink, and my husband's going to say, Beth, what did you do?
Yeah. What is that? Yeah, it re-comes together in all your plumbing. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And then I'd be in big trouble, wouldn't I? Huge trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty safe. I don't know what it is. So it's probably bad. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, now I have a picture of a big glob right in the bottom of the drain. Ugh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because see, I'd be the one that'd have to fix that. So yeah. No.
Mm-mm. Yeah. No.
Crawl under the cabinet, get that edge of the cabinet line of bruising on my back, so I can clean out some gunk. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, yes. Or it's all the way down the line at our house. That's where it would be. And Max would be like, okay, I had to open the other end. What did you do? What did you do? Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yep. We can all picture that. Yep.
Yep, we can. Yes, we can. Yeah, we can. So but that's interesting. So you like the thicker, because I know what you're talking about, that stabilizer that – it is. It looks like handmade paper, but it tears out okay. You don't have a problem with disturbing your stitching, or do you put so much stitching on that, it kind of perforates it pretty good?
Yeah, I tend to sort of tear it away from the edge before I stitch the edge because it's quite fibrous, so it will leave little tentacles sticking out from under my stitches. So I do I am mindful of when I'm coming to the edge of something. And really, I'm only loosely using it as a guide anyway, because of the way I stitch is, I'm not the most technical of stitchers, but I try to sort of be quite free with how I'm doing stuff. So the pattern evolves anyway. It's not necessarily, I don't stick to what's on there.
Right. That makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I'm doing a crewel piece, crewel wool piece, and it's the first piece of surface embroidery I've done in a long time. And the adjustment, knowing I can put the needle wherever I want it and there's freedom, has been really difficult, because I'm so used to needle point and cross stitch where it goes in this hole and only this hole. And I know what you mean about being, start out with a general idea and then work it from there. Yeah.
Yeah, I absolutely marvel at cross stitch and counted cross stitch. I do not have the mind to do something like that at all. I can follow a pattern ish, but I definitely prefer to be freer. And, I tend to, although I say I thread paint, I use two strands of stranded cotton, and I also will tend to layer and go back over. And I'm not necessarily doing the sort of beautiful long and short stitch that I see those incredible thread painters do. I try to use thread more like paint. So I layer and go back and, change direction and all that kind of thing.
If we were to pick up one of your pieces, in some areas there might be three or four layers of thread just to create what you want, and other places might just be one then.
Yeah, exactly.
So you do mainly long and short, just not formally. I know I was looking at one of your Instagram posts and you said you put some bullion knots on. How did you like doing that?
So I absolutely love doing French knots and bullion knots, and I see posts about people hating it so much, but I really enjoy it. I find the sort of like this, when you get a really perfect one, it's such a good feeling. But I also quite enjoy when they go a little bit wrong as well, because they kind of give, I don't know, I've always enjoyed that. I make my works about flaws and glitches, and sometimes when it goes a bit sort of sideways, I enjoy that as well. But I do enjoy them when they go perfect.
so you don't need every single one to be absolutely perfect. Probably takes some of the stress out of doing them, because if you want them all to be exactly exact, then bullion knots can be a bit tedious sometimes. I mean, I love them, but sometimes they're just a pain.
And I don't, I'm looking at some of my work now and I'm trying to see any, and I don't use them very often, so I can't enjoy them that much.
Yeah, and people get just in a rage over French knots, and I think some of that is they're studying it too close, because you don't have to get very far away from them and they're all just little knobs. But I think it's people looking at them through magnifiers and they're not everyone the same. Yeah, probably not. But
From
3 feet away, they're just knobs. So who cares?
Yeah. And I always say to people, if I've ever teach workshops or help people with embroidery, no one's ever looking at it as close as you are. No one's ever going to be that, you're inside of your work sometimes, you're so in it. And as soon as you stand back, you don't see all of those little flaws and silly little things that you worry about. So,
right. So true. Right. Now you come at this with some pretty serious education, art education, with printed textile design. Talk about how you started.
Yeah. Well, I only have art education. I don't have anything else. I was home educated, I went to normal school, and then sort of just before I would have done my In the UK, we do GCSEs when you're around, I think it's about 16. And then you go on to A-levels, and then usually you go to university after that. I left before the GCSEs, so I studied for them because I needed to get the points to get into my next course, because I had intentions to go back into formal education. And I ended up being advised that I could go and take this course called the GNBQ in art and design, which would give me those points. It was a year-long course, I think, that would give me those points so I could go and do a art foundation. It was actually called a national diploma because it was a two-year foundation course, which would then allow me to go to university. So I only, I don't have any maths or English, doing my taxes is a nightmare. I only have, you know, the very useful qualifications in art. So I did this amazing diploma in art and design in Brighton, which it was sort of, we specialized in the second year, and I chose fashion and textiles. And then from there, I went to Central St. Martin's and studied textile design. And we did weave, print and knit. And then I specialised in printed textile design, because at the time there was no embroidery degree at all. And I would have definitely have gone and done an embroidery degree if it had existed. But that was sort of the nearest best thing that I could do. But I still was embroidering all the time with my printed textiles. I used to machine embroider over everything that I did. It was always my passion.
So where did this is so interesting, because we've talked to several people who started out in fashion and textiles and, you know, the haute couture world, and then moved to embroidery. But you had embroidery in you before you even went to college then?
Yeah, drawing, and my mum is a real keen embroiderer and knitter, and so I always worked with textiles when I was young, and it just felt really natural to draw with the machine, with the sewing machine. And I didn't really know anything about hand embroidery particularly, but I used to just use my machine to draw over everything, especially at university, because I don't think I wasn't very good at printing either, so I kind of used it to to cover up the mistakes. But I don't know, I've always really enjoyed how thread looks.
There's a true artist, put another layer on top to make it look good, it'll be okay.
yeah
So machine, and then when did the hand embroidery come in?
So after university, I ended up working in sort of fashion retail, really, as a visual merchandiser, and did various jobs doing that. And then I started working with an artist, Robert Montgomery. He is a poet. And the way we worked together very much was that I am good at making things. So I ended up taking over the construction of all of his work, which is mostly large scale LED light sculptures. Occasionally we'd make other things, fire poems, for example. And during our work together, he was very interested in the north of England, there is a culture of making textile banners for protests, especially the coal miners' protests. And they're beautiful, really incredibly hand-embroidered protest banners. So he had an idea about making his works with these, so with the poems, but in a sort of beautiful textile way. So because I had this textile background, we started making those together. And I all of a sudden found my passion. I was like, I forgot, I love embroidery, I love making textiles, and started just hand embroidering myself, you know, in my spare time. And that was it. I had the bug, and I went and did a couple of courses at the Royal School of Needlework, because I'm really lucky I'm in London, so it's not that far away. And yeah, and just started embroidering and put a few things online and started getting commissions, and that was it. Yeah.
What a path. What a path.
Right. Right.
So the sculpture work was LED lights.
Yeah. So, I mean, we made the biggest one, I think we made was 52 meters wide. We made huge pieces, and, they look sort of like, you know, like a shop sign or something like that, but they were all his poetry. And then sometimes I'd make them out of wood and we would set them on fire. we worked together for about 8 years, and it was a really interesting experience. I had no idea about the art world, and he, you know, we had, I think we worked with 8 different galleries around the world, and, you know, I got to travel to India and, you know, amazing time making, you know, I just used to pack my drills and go off and build some huge sculpture. And yeah, I don't know if I could do something like that. I think I was more fearless. Now I sit in my studio making hand embroidery.
That's so interesting. I had a sense just doing research that period for you was really eye-opening and horizon broadening in a lot of ways. It was just little things I picked up that it really was instrumental in what you do today in terms of just freeing your art mind, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. It took me a little bit of time to find my way on my own. I think I had my doubts of whether, you know, I think everybody who calls themselves an artist finds it difficult to call themselves an artist at one point, because you don't know whether you're actually making art. and I think it took me a few years after I stopped working with Rob to figure out what I really wanted to do and build up the confidence to make my own artwork. But I met, during the period I was working with Rob, I met some really incredible people, and I'm lucky that a lot of those people have, you know, stayed with me as an artist, and they encourage me to make the work that I'm doing now, which is really nice.
Did you leave Robert to go to something else, or did you say, hey, I need to go see if I can find my own way?
Yeah, I left and I was like, I'm going to try and have a little hand embroidery studio and, you know, see how it goes.
And it went. Yay.
Yes.
So what did you, when you did that, what were your plans? What did you start in terms of just designs that came to you and trying to do commission work or teach, or what was your plan?
Well, I had this grand plan, which was a total failure. I was going to revolutionize the world. I collected a group of tattoo artists that I really, really loved their work. And tattoo, funnily, very strange to think, but tattoo artwork and a lot of embroidery artwork are very similar, especially for kits, because, you know, really the way that you make a tattoo is an outline and then you fill it in. And I was like, this is perfect for embroidery. So I designed, I think it was about 5 different embroidery kits with various tattoo artists. And I wanted to sell them as art editions, so that even if you didn't actually make them, you had a sort of piece of art that you could, you know, it was signed by the tattoo artist. And it was this whole plan, and I did the whole thing, and I sold about 3 of them. it was a bit of a failure. But it was a good experience for me, because I learned a lot about, you know, embroidery at the time. And yeah, it was an experience.
Well, and I find that interesting because I was just, I'm looking it up now. I was at a art museum, and I can't remember if it was the Harvard Art Museum or the Boston Art Museum, but there was a doll that was, it was like a an advertising sign, and someone had bought the doll and tattooed it and then done, I want to say, a little bit of gold work embroidery on it. Right. So when you were talking, I was like, wait, that sounded like a fantastic idea. And I don't do tattoos. I'm not, I mean, I don't have any tattoos. I'm, but I could see where that would be. And that's just surprising to me that that's not, that didn't go.
Yeah, because maybe I was ahead of my time or something. I don't know. I didn't really have the infrastructure to really design a kit that I think worked on all levels. I think if I was to do it again, I don't know. I'm not really a person who makes kits. So I think I would have to work with somebody who does, who would be able to tell me what they would need from the instructions and, you know, from what I don't really know what you would want in a kit. So I think that's where I fell down, really thinking like, oh, everyone's just going to sort of wing it like I do.
No. I can tell you that. I mean, because I sometimes teach at my guild, or we offer something and we're like, okay, so you're going to choose your own colors. And immediately, you know, more than half of everybody drops out because they're like, and it's like, no, you get the chart, you get everything. All you have to do is choose your own colors. No, absolutely not. So having to figure out where you're going to place your stitch would just really throw them for a loop too. But yeah, I think that idea, I don't know. I don't think that's a bad idea.
No,
so much of the tattoo work is gorgeous, and I think some of it's timeless. In fact, I watch Antiques Roadshow, and I think somebody was selling the sheets from some famous tattoo artist of, you know, what he had postered on his wall. That can get this tattoo, and I thought, yeah, that's art, you know.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Pretty lucky. I had one of the artists is an artist called Alex Binney, and he really is sort of a legend in the sort of tattoo world. And he also is he makes lino block prints, which are really stunning. He really is like an incredible artist in his own. And he also now makes embroidery. I think even if I got that one person making embroideries from this little project, I'm happy. But yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, maybe in the future there will be some. I'd love to go back to designing some embroidery kits, but it just wasn't maybe. I think my headspace was, I need to make this a business because I need to pay the rent. I need to, you know, right. And I don't think that ever makes a good business. You know, I think I obviously I'm passionate about it, but I think I went into it with the wrong, I don't know. I think, I don't know. It wasn't a success, but I didn't give up. It just took me a while. It just took me a while to realize that actually, you know, it's okay to be a bit broke and make the art that you love. And you take a risk, and it sort of works out better that way, I think, because people can see the sort of integrity in your work rather than, you know, the sort of paint by numbers. I'm trying to blog my embroidery to you on Instagram or whatever it is, you know.
Right.
Well, but isn't that what art is? You take a risk. I mean, it's at whatever level you do it, you're just taking a shot and seeing if it comes out, and adapting from there. So Geez, I like the idea. Now you got my head about, because you know, I'm with you, Beth. I mean, I don't have a tattoo and have no interest, but I really admire good tattoos because it really is art. There's our favorite Mexican restaurant. One of the servers there, she has a tattoo on her arm. One day, I just stopped her. I said, you know, I got to look at this, because you know, explain to me what this is. And where it came from, and because it was just beautifully done, and you know, it was just true art. And now you got me thinking, yeah, you could take that and embroider that and really make it into something. That would be cool. Oh man,
yeah,
and especially I like the idea that you had people who were famous in the tattoo artist world. You know, that was fantastic. So don't let go of that idea. I guess that's what we're telling you. You might just have to work it.
My boyfriend's actually a tattoo artist, but he tattoos the traditional way, just with you know, without a machine. He does it by hand, and it's quite funny because we both do hand. You know, they call it hand poke tattoo, and I poke with a needle the same. We both pretty much do the same thing, but. Has very different connotations, you know, to the world that I make embroidery and he's a tattoo artist.
Oh, yeah, so you're both stabbing things, you know.
Yeah.
just stabbing things. Yeah. Perfect.
So when it comes to your work, what is your general process? Are you one of those people with a sketchbook all the time who's constantly scratching out ideas, or do you just sit down with a piece of cloth and some thread and let it flow out of your head?
No, I am. I really work with technology all the time. I love nature. So if I'm out and I see flowers or birds or butterflies or anything, I'm taking photos on my phone. I wish I drew more. I just don't. I'm a researcher. I like to sit on my computer and look through things. And I don't draw anymore, unfortunately.
So you work from base photos then?
Yeah. Yeah. Either my photos or photographs of, you know, like I said, with the bouquets that I use as inspiration, I asked my friend if I could use her photos. But yeah, I don't draw at all, really. I'm trying to think if I have done recently, and I haven't. No.
But see, sounds like you're using the technology that's available instead. You know, it's just a different way of, I think, of sketching, I think, you know.
Yeah.
So what tools do you use? You iPad, and what apps do you use? What are your primary tools?
Yeah, so I have my iPad, and I have one of those amazing Apple pens. So if I am going to draw, I'm usually tracing something. And like I said, I've been utilizing this AI technology and experimenting with that quite a lot over the last few months. I am really interested. I'm not the most technically proficient person, but I am super interested in technology, and I really like the idea of using especially advanced technology within my practice as an embroidery artist, because I think the mix of the tradition and the new is really interesting. I'm about to show three of my, I call them paintings, my embroideries at a AI and art show. It's a science and art, I'm trying to find the words. It's a conference based in Turin, which has been going for about 20 years, and they talk about science and art, and this year it's all about AI and artists that utilize AI in different ways in their art. So I was chosen to be one of six artists in that. So I'm really excited because everyone else is very technological and, you know, projection mapping and all these different crazy things that I don't understand at all. And then there's going to be my little, you know, traditional hand embroideries in the corner. So I'm quite excited about going to see that. Yeah.
That is so cool. Because, see, I added a magazine for manufacturing plants. And we use a lot of stock photography from Adobe. And here in the last couple of months, there have been several images that I have, as I look through the stock for manufacturing images, that have been spot on, like really good, really. But they had a look to them. And mm-hmm. And I thought, this doesn't seem like a photo to me. And then I discovered that they are now providing a good number of AI-generated photos. Mm. And I can't bring myself to use one in the magazine because there's just that little bit of artificial to it that I just can't get over the hump with it. But they're excellent in terms of subject matter. And and I really want to use them, but I just can't. You know, I can't make myself do it, but it is becoming a reality, and I mean, it's photography, it's art, you know, it's just a different form of art, but that's interesting that here you've attached it to embroidery, so.
Yeah, AI is fascinating, and I'm fascinated with the conversation around it. You know, a lot of artists are angry for reasons that I don't particularly understand. So I think maybe a lot of people don't understand how it actually works. And I think there's a sort of misunderstanding that maybe it's sort of replicating other artists' imagery, which is not really how it works. But I do think it's an interesting conversation. There are art prizes for AI art now, and there are it's very interesting and I think that if I can play around with it, especially with the subject matter of my work and the idea of, you know, technology possibly becoming a problem, you know, becoming something like a nuclear disaster, a technological oil spill would be just as interesting to me. So, I like the weirdness of them, you know, when they go wrong and, you know, they've got eight fingers and, you know, I really love all of that. That's really what I'm drawn to with the AI, although it can make these perfect, incredible images and, you know, I like it when it goes wrong.
That's right. Yeah, it's fascinating world. I took for an editorial actually in the last issue. I thought, what if I take one of the big question issues of the day in manufacturing and sent it to Google's Bard AI system and said, "Hey, give me 500 words on this topic." What would I get back? And what I got back was it couldn't even generate 500 words. It only was like 377 or something like that, of just nothing but repetition and buzzwords. And it was okay. My job is safe as an editor for a while because if that's the best it can do. But it did it in like, I don't know, 4 or 5 seconds. It had almost 400 words on the topic that to someone who really doesn't know actually would make some sense until you read it a second time and realize it's just repeating phrases and buzzwords. And, but then, you know, I look at that stock photography and I'm telling you, it's really good. It really is. So there's a place. I don't know. Just stay away from the words. I have a job to do. Yeah. Okay, so 2022 Hand and Lock Prize winner. That must have been like cloud nine twice.
It feels a bit surreal because I entered purely to give me a reason just to make the work and not beat myself up about not doing commissions or I was like, right, you're going to give yourself, I think I spent 3 months on them actually in total. And I was like, right, you're just doing this for this reason. And my goal was to get through to the final because I thought, oh, I can exhibit my work and I'll get a mentor, which will be amazing. And when I got through, I was so excited and so happy. And then I found out that Diana Springall was my mentor and was even more excited. And then we were supposed to find out about the winners in November of 2022, but they had to cancel the event because of train strike, classic British infrastructure thing. And they rescheduled it to January this year. And I thought, I don't really care if I win. And I got what I wanted out of it. And I sort of forgot about it almost. And then the week before came and my mum called me and said, oh, am I coming to the, awards ceremony? And I was like, oh, no, don't bother coming, mum. I'm not going to win. And then I went along and I won. The first thing I thought was like, my mum's going to be so angry with me.
Yeah, I would be. If I'd been your mum, I would have been very angry with you.
Sorry, mum. But obviously she was ecstatic for me. So, yeah, it all kind of was a bit of a blur, really. But I have to say that the most amazing thing that came out of it was meeting Diana Springall, who has really taken me under her wing. And I went a few months back, she commissioned a piece for her collection, and I went to deliver it to her amazing house, which is not far from where I live, and spent the day with her. And she's just incredible. And she inspires me so much to carry on and keep being an artist. And yeah, that's definitely one of the best things that have come out of all of that.
Okay, I'm going to ask the dumb guy question. Tell us who Diana Springall is.
So Diana Springall, she doesn't mind me saying, but she is in her 80s now, and she is a textile artist who really sort of was quite well known, I guess, sort of throughout the 70s and the 80s. She doesn't work as much these days. She does teach. And she has the Diana Springall collection. You can go online in Diana Springall collection. It's all up there. And she has one of the most incredible embroidery collections, machine embroidery, hand embroidery, and lathe, all sorts of things, and that she's collected from all over the world. And she is a champion of embroidery artists, especially here in the UK. She's been a mentor with the Hand and Knot Prize, I think, from the beginning. And her collection is about to, they're fundraising at the moment to build a wing at the Sunbury Gallery. So it will be permanently housed as an embroidery collection altogether forever, which is amazing. And when that happens, that everyone could be able to go and see it, because it's just, the collection, even the little bits that I saw when I went to visit her recently, but was amazing. She also made quite a lot of rugs and interiors and things. Yeah, she's about 4'11" and she's incredible. She's amazing. I'm 6 foot, so we look quite hilarious together, actually.
So winning the Hand and Lock Prize was nice, but getting to work with her is almost the next level then.
Yeah, definitely. And Hand and Lock are amazing. And we are putting on an exhibition in November. It'll be last year's finalist and finalists and this year's finalist. So that'll be really exciting to be part of that. And the Hand and Lock Prize is really, it's really amazing. But yeah, Diana is. Yeah, she's a good one.
So when you went to the ceremony, you knew you were a finalist, but you didn't know if you'd won. So it was.
Yeah.
So is that when they announce your name, you just kind of sit there for a moment in disbelief?
I think I turned to my boyfriend and went, I did it. I believe it. It's so funny because they picked,
oh, wait a minute. Your boyfriend went and your mom didn't? Oh, ouch.
Yeah.
Oh.
I know.
Oh. Oh.
Don't rub it in or get in trouble all over again.
Sorry.
it's funny because they because it's a open embroidery competition for all types of embroidery, the finalists in my group were so varied that it was, I don't know how the judges pick, because you know every single entry is incredible and so different, and you know, because we all respond to the brief in such different ways, I don't know how they pick. So I didn't really have any idea who would have won out of my category.
Yeah. When that happens, what happens to you after the fact? Do you hear from people you've never heard from, get inquiries? What's the aftermath of something like that? Because, I mean, that's serious prize. You know, how does your life get altered when that happens?
Yeah, I had inquiries from people that want to exhibit my work and people that want to buy my work, which I panicked because I didn't have anything. But it also sort of galvanized me to think, right, oh, actually, you can do this. I got a bit of a seal of approval that, you know, I'm sure a lot of people are home alone making embroidery on their own, and you don't know if it's any good or not, whatever that means. You know, you don't know if that you're completely delusional and you're just making a mess, or that people will understand what you're trying to say. And for me, that gave me, two of the judges were people that I, you know, Cornelia Parker, who I've looked up to forever, and Philip Tracy, who I think, you know, I had in scrapbooks when I was a student. And, you know, for them to even see my work was, you know, that made, and the fact that they judged mine the winner, that made me feel like, yeah, actually I can do this, and I can spend, you know, like I have done the next however many months it's been since January, I don't even know what wherever we are in the year, at just making art and not worrying too much about, you know, if I'm doing the right thing or not. I feel like I'm doing the right thing.
So do you have to then be careful that you don't, this isn't going to come out right, I mean, that you stay true to your art after something like that, and you don't go off trying to create something that the judges are going to like the next time? I mean, is there a mental struggle there that you have to deal with?
No, I haven't really thought about that so much.
Oh, good. Now I put that in your head. Sorry.
No, I'm thinking that. No, because you don't know. You can't. I was a finalist in this year's Fine Art Textile Awards, which I was on the fence about entering, and I thought, oh, why not? I'll enter, you know, you never know. And again, I was shocked and happy to become a finalist. And then I think there was 14 finalists, and this is textile, so completely open, you know, you have all sorts of incredible works made out of all different materials, and I didn't win, but I didn't think I had a chance. When I looked at the other works, I thought, well, this is impossible. I don't know who's going to win this, because everybody's work is such a high standard, so completely different. There was no brief, we just entered whatever you wanted, so I don't even know how you even begin to judge something like that. And I couldn't possibly put myself in the mind of a judge. So, yeah, I don't really think about that.
That sounds kind of random. So even being a finalist then is almost winning in its own right, just because of the randomness of the thing.
It was good. I mean, it's all very nice, you know. It's all, yeah. I just, yeah. It's, yeah. It's good. It feels, you know. I spent a long time, well, not a long time, but I spent like a few years really not knowing what to do, and you know, making those mistakes and making decisions that didn't really work. And I feel like the last 2 years, first with Hand and Lock, and then now the Fine Art Textile Prize, and having a few exhibitions that are coming up at the end of this year, it's been a really, like, I'm trying to find the word, I can't think of what I'm saying. You know, it just feels like I'm doing the right thing, and I'm keeping moving, which is nice, you know, like, oh, then there's this, and then there's this, you know, whereas before I just sort of didn't know what I was doing, and I was stuck making pet portraits, which is great. I love doing that. I absolutely love making pet portraits, but I wasn't going anywhere. And right. Where now I just feel like it's keeping on.
So do you work a series until you're totally, like, it, ideas are totally gone?
Yeah. I made three works in collaboration with the AI, and then I decided that I wanted to make another two, so I'm on the fifth one now. And I would like to finish, but I was having a play around with the AI yesterday, and there is still some more that I'd like to do, so I think I'll probably carry on working with the AI for a bit.
Well, and I find that interesting because, I was just in Boston looking at paintings, and, you know, you've got Monet, who, you know, he worked in a series. He, you know, depending on the time of day, and he didn't care about the subject so much, but he wanted to play with the light. And so It seems like you're that way with the AI. It's like, I thought it was done, but maybe I need to play with this a little bit to see what happens.
Well, the next thing is that I can now put what I've made back into the AI, and the AI will create new images based on the embroideries that I've made. So I think then it would be interesting to then embroider those next ones and almost have a conversation with the AI.
Oh, absolutely. Oh my word. I love that idea.
Because this series is almost using the AI like an oracle for the future, to see what this, you know, this idea of this, you know, post-apocalyptic future mutation and blah, blah, blah may look like. But then if I'm telling the AI this is what it looks like, what is the next phase of the conversation? And with AI becoming more sophisticated, and, you know, it's... because it's learning every day to see sort of where it goes. The most interesting thing that I found when I've done it previously was that it understands the floral nature of the work, even though it's abstracted. It makes it less abstract. So maybe the final thing is just a normal embroidered flower. I don't know, but it would be interesting to see where it goes, and then I'll probably get bored. If it becomes a normal flower, I'll be bored.
Right, you have to go. You have to try something. Something new will catch your eye. Is my guess.
Fascinating. See, yeah, that the whole AI thing, of course, in the news. You know, there's all the people who are convinced it's going to be the end of us, and then others say, no, it's not. But then, you know, to hear your perspective, there's some real value there and a real good tool to kind of expand your thinking and just and answer that what if question. Yeah.
Maybe. Who knows?
Before we run out of time here, pet projects brings up commission work. Do you do much commission work? I always find that the commission work, if I were in your position and created something, number one, how do I create something that I know the client's going to like, But number two, after I create it, how do I let it out the door? I mean, it's I made it, you know.
Oh, I love things going. I love sending it off. It's my favorite part. I love working with clients. I've worked with all sorts of clients doing all sorts of things over the years and feel so lucky to do each one. I mean, sometimes I'm just embroidering names on. I work with a girl who has this great little company called Smoking Jackets, where she has this beautiful fabric and she makes these little cigarette boxes. And I personalize them for her. And I love doing that as much as I love doing a pet portrait. The pet portraits are always quite emotional. A lot of the time the dogs have passed away or the cats have passed away, which is, you know, I have to be really mindful of the, you know, it takes a lot to ask someone to make something to memorialize your pet. So I put a lot of passion into them. I definitely don't charge enough for them, and I really hope that they can keep them forever and you know, feel that connection with their pet. Then I do other silly things. I just made a ice cream sandwich on a baseball cap for somebody, which obviously has no emotional attachment to anybody, but it's just as fun, and it keeps me on my toes a little bit because I have to use techniques that I don't use all the time, and do what they ask of me a lot of the time. You know, I try and be as accommodating as possible.
Oh, but then you did the wedding dress with the sea creatures on it.
Yeah, that was really fun. I mean, the dress that she gave me was really, it was tattered and had holes in it. She'd found it in a thrift store, and you know, I don't think she really realized the state that it was in. So I ended up, like usual with commissions, doing sort of over and above what she asked, because all the little sea creatures had to patch up all of these holes in the netting of the dress. But the sweetest thing that she said to me was, so when they were signing their wedding, I don't know what you do when you get married, I'm not married, but when they were signing the thing, her husband kept saying to her, oh look, jellyfish, and like, and picking up her dress and looking all over it. So, yeah.
I thought that was fantastic, and the fact that she, I guess I didn't catch on that it was like she bought it at a thrift store, and it had holes in it. That's even better. That's even better. That makes the story even better.
Yeah, I didn't pick up on that at all. Yeah, now I got to go back and look at the pictures and realize all the sea creatures are covering holes, okay? Hey, it worked out great, you know?
Applause. It's beautiful.
Yeah, well done.
Beautiful, yeah. Yeah, the weddings, I've done a few weddings. I don't know if it's on my website, actually, but she wanted lots of little emblems just on the sleeves of her wedding dress, and they were all little things like you know, like the Eiffel Tower and the poetry book that her and her husband all had in common. It was just these little parts of their relationship on her sleeve, and yeah, there's something really sweet about doing weddings because it does have that symbol, you know, and because it, on the day you show your partner and they can spot all those little things that are just for you two. I really enjoy doing those.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Excellent. Yep. All right, Lucy, thank you so much. This has really been terrific, and what a ride to get where you're at. Yeah. The meandering path that finally gets you to where it works. That's terrific. Yep. Well, thanks for doing this. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. And thanks to everyone for listening.